$60 billion. That's how much the New York City Housing Authority estimates it should invest in its infrastructure over the next 5 years. NYCHA, as it's called, comprises the city's largest supply of deeply affordable housing, and it faces persistent challenges. A large recurring gap between its regular operating costs and revenues caused by rising expenses and weakened rent collections, deteriorating physical conditions that are driving up its capital and operating costs and negatively affecting the lives of many of its over 500,000 residents, and a pressing need to continue to implement its plan to improve and modernize management. But what should be done with rent collection and operating costs? What are the strategies to rehabilitate and rebuild properties? And is there enough money to even do it? And how are the lives of NYCHA residents changing? Are there historically persistent lead, mold, and elevator problems getting better? Fortunately, today we get to delve into these very questions with NYCHA's leadership. Hello, I'm Andrew Ryan, President of the Citizens Budget Commission, and thanks for joining us for another episode of What's the Data Point? Today we talk with NYCHA CEO Lisa Bova Hyatt and Chair Jamie Rubin, who are charged with managing and improving the nation's largest public housing system. NYCHA houses 1 in 7 New Yorkers. That's more residents than the city of Atlanta. Our discussion touches on their work to comply with the monitorship agreement with HUD in the Southern District, to decentralize management, to use data effectively, involve tenants in deciding how to rehabilitate their housing, how to leverage private capital, improving housing conditions, maintenance, lead removal, and so much more. I hope the conversation provides a clear look at the scope of the challenges facing NYCHA and the breadth of the strategies that leadership is using to solve them. So until next time, when you hear a public official talk about a policy or a program or even a proposal, always remember to ask, what is the data point? Thank you all for coming today.
I'm so happy.
Thank you for having us. And it's good, Andrew said I'm a trustee. I've been a trustee for many years since I left the state, and it's a great organization. Obviously, if you are a trustee, thanks for the support. And if you're not a trustee and you're here because Betsy wants to make you a trustee, you should absolutely sign on immediately.
Well, I appreciate that.
See, I earned my keep. I'm not going to say anything else.
When you were appointed, one of our trustees called and said, why'd you let Jamie do that?
There you go.
But
when I was appointed to NYCHA.
What?
I think when I was appointed to the
No, board. when you were appointed to okay. NYCHA, and I said, I know the guy fairly well, and there's stuff to do. And Jamie's always stepped up, so thank you. And Lisa has been in it for a long time. So we have a lot to talk about. We'll talk about the operations, we'll talk about the budget, we'll talk about the capital plan, maybe we can even get to the monitorship, and in the next 7 hours, we'll talk about the rest of it. But why don't you help us, because not everyone is as ensconced as you, and I've learned a lot over the last 6 years, and still so much more to know. But could you just open up and tell us a little about NYCHA, but really the environment within which you're working? You have the HUD and Southern District Agreement. That's kind of governing what you do. So just give us the lay of the land before we jump into details.
Absolutely. So thank you so much for inviting us, because I feel like the more that Jamie and I are out there speaking about NYCHA, the more people really get an inside view of what it's actually like to run the largest public housing authority in the United States. Just by way of background, NYCHA houses 1 in 17 New Yorkers. 1 in 17 New Yorkers. We're the largest landlord in the city of New York. Our portfolio is over 175,000 apartments. We are larger than the city of Atlanta. We are larger than the city of Orlando. But we don't have the tax revenue that those cities do to run their cities. We are nearly 100 years old, and we have suffered from decades of federal disinvestment. We have a $4 billion operating budget, and a large portion of that is rent. Unfortunately, I started at NYCHA 3 weeks before the pandemic. And if you can imagine, we all know that it was a huge health crisis for not just the individuals in New York, but across the globe. But it was also an economic crisis, especially for the people that we house, people who are the most vulnerable New Yorkers. including the fact that the federal government had a program called the Emergency Rental Assistance Program. Our state legislature decided that people who live in subsidized housing should not be eligible for ERAP protection. So over 4 years, we accumulated a $500 million debt. We are owed $500 million in rent arrears. That's significant. Although it's gone down now, it's about $450 million. When you're using a third of your, when that accounts for a third of your operating revenue, that's a huge hit. HUD does not make up that difference. So we are trying to do the best that we can with infrastructure that is incredibly aging. Literally, when you fix one pipe, a leak starts on a different floor, and I'm not kidding. We have fires. We probably have two fires a day, just given the amount of buildings that we have. So operationally, it's really an incredible challenge. In 2019, we signed an agreement with HUD, the city, and the Southern District because of missteps that the NYCHA management had taken regarding lead. And I have to tell you, although I wasn't at NYCHA at the time, I really think it was the best thing that could have ever happened to the organization. We have tremendous oversight. I am a believer in oversight. I think it's like free technical assistance. And I think having both management and staff being held accountable is a really good thing. So we speak regularly to HUD. We speak to the Southern District. We have a new monitor that started at the end of February, Jenner and Block. And we are really at a different place than we were when I arrived at NYCHA. We are using data-driven metrics to really look at the way our operations work, which is something that we did not do before. We are really reimagining what NYCHA can be, and we're using every available tool that we have, whether it's the PACT program — I see a bunch of our PACT developers in the audience — whether it's the trust, which was passed by the state legislature in 2022, which really holistically rehabilitates our properties, but leaves the management to NYCHA. We have our comprehensive modernization program. For the first time at Fulton Elliott Chelsea, we are reimagining what our buildings could be and what additional affordable housing, both market and affordable housing, could be if we rebuilt on our properties. And with an aging infrastructure — and I know this is something that you've talked about a lot — you have to think about whether it's more cost-effective to rebuild rather than rehabilitate. And because we have such a vast portfolio — we have low rises, we have high rises, we have developments in the toniest neighborhoods, we have developments that are really in, transportation deserts — there can't be a one-size-fits-all approach for the way that we do things. We're also really leaning into training, not only technology, but training and culture, which is something that is a very hard thing to change. I am the most positive person probably in this room, which is probably one of the reasons why I accepted this position. I think when you work at NYCHA as a CEO and you have all of the challenges that we do every day, you have to wake up every morning and say, today is going to be a great day, no matter what happens. And I do that over and over.
Before you learn about the two fires.
Even after I learn about it. We get updates like every 2 hours as to what's going on. But we have started programs like we had a muster pilot. So we have our caretakers that work at our developments. And what we're doing is we're doing training at every morning muster that is consistent across all of the developments. So we have Mindfulness Monday, we have Safety Tuesday, we have Wednesday, I think, is, you know, there are different things, but there's consistency. So if you're working at Mariner's Harbor in Staten Island, you're getting the same information as the person who's working at Fulton or Elliott Chelsea. So that if we're transferring caretakers from Staten Island to Manhattan to Brooklyn to Queens, that there's going to be a consistency. And we're teaching very basic things. Let me remind you how to mop. Let's talk about some of the challenges that you're having. So we're really taking a holistic approach to how to really make NYCHA really the shining star that it is. I can't imagine a New York City without a NYCHA, and I hope you can't either.
So you laid out a lot to talk about. Why don't we start to unpack? You mentioned operations, capital, you know, facilities, rent arrears. Let's start with the operations. And the monitors set forth a number of pillars. You had lead, and you already had a mold monitor, and then there were operational restructuring, including on the, there's a transformation plan.
Yes.
On management, you were to start a compliance and quality assurance unit, decentralize management. Tell us, how has management been restructured, including, as you say, to use data and metrics to manage what is a large decentralized system?
Sure. So feel free to jump in anytime you want. But
I will.
I can talk about this all day. And I'm sorry
I'll
we have such a short amount of time. But so I think the as part of the transformation plan, the most significant management change was bifurcating the roles of the chair and CEO. Historically, and pursuant to state statute, the public housing law, the CEO and the chair were the same person. Now, I'm sure there are a bunch of you who sit on boards and might even be a board chair. Can you imagine being both a board chair and the CEO of an organization that spans the entire footprint of the city of New York and has 12,000 employees? It's just not appropriate. And if you look at every other PHA in the country, and I should say, just to put it in context, NYCHA is larger than the next 9 public housing authorities combined. It's just not a model that works. So I think starting with that, bifurcating those roles was really incredibly transformative. Creating a compliance unit, and it still sort of boggles the mind that in, you know, 2020 or 2019, NYCHA, as large as it was, didn't have a robust compliance unit. And I know that Jamie meets with our head of compliance fairly regularly, going through dashboards to show the productivity of our operations, our skilled trades. So that is another huge component. And then work order reform. If you look back at the way NYCHA was organized, we had skilled trades that were going from Staten Island to Queens to Upper Manhattan, sometimes on the same day. And if anyone has tried to navigate traffic, you can imagine just the amount of time that it would take to move around the city effectively. What we did pursuant to the transformation plan is work order reform. We now have skilled trades that work in neighborhoods. So they're not going very far, which means their productivity has increased exponentially.
You know, the a couple of quick observations that just things that I've seen since I came on in the summer of, at the end of the summer of last year, that Lisa didn't mention. One is at the headquarters and in the sort of the 1,000 or so people that work in the headquarters staff. The place has been de-siloized, which is
a fancy word.
It's not very fancy. I think I made it up. But anecdotally, I remember when I was state housing commissioner, I told Lisa this story. The state, for the first time in a long time, appropriated $100 million for us to give to NYCHA, and they sent it through my agency. I said, okay, great. I called up the then CEO of the agency, and I said, I'm going to walk over, and you tell me how you'd like us to give it to you. You know, what are you going to spend it on? Because that's the rule. So I walked over with one person, showed up, and she had 40 people in the room. It was extraordinary. And I leaned over to my person I came up with, and I said, this is clearly never going to work. And we left, and it never got spent. The difference between that model and the model that Lisa has implemented with her senior team, some of whom are here today, is extraordinary. There's, you know, there's cross-cutting responsibilities. People talk to each other. There's no duplication of jobs and roles, which is incredibly important. You know, you don't have six general counsels for each area. You've got one general counsel to whom all the lawyers report. It's stuff that probably makes sense to people in this room and for some reason never got implemented before that. Saves money, makes things more efficient, makes the place operate better. But that's, you know, it's all relatively recent. It sort of happened because of the monitor, but frankly, it just happened because the monitor didn't order it. The team that was in place had to figure out how to make things work better with the same amount of resources.
So if you could just help us kind of put some flesh on the bones, how often do you have a dashboard? Do you have regular accountability meetings? What's your process? And, you know, I was looking, you know, the outgoing monitor wrote a long report, but said it was the best lead testing and abatement program in the country, reduced mold complaints by 50%. On the other hand, as I look at the MMR, non-emergency service requests, which the emergency service requests time frame has come down a little, but still not close to pre-pandemic, but the non-emergency service requests are three times what they were in terms of response time pre-pandemic. What data are you looking at? Where do you see successes and where are the things that are not going well?
So we have so many dashboards that I feel like our dashboards have dashboards. Mm-hmm. Like we can look at any skilled trade and see by borough, by development, we can break it down. We can, you know, it's extraordinary the work that both operations and compliance has done. We meet regularly. I think the most significant meeting that we now have, aside from like obviously our executive staff meetings, I have meetings with all of, you know, the head of operations, the head of our capital program. But we have a meeting between our executive staff that capital and our COO's office lead. You know, 4 years ago, capital didn't speak to operations. So it would be like when, if you recall in the 90s when, you know, it's a story that I remember when I first got to the law department, you know, they would, DOT would pave a road and then DEP would chop it up to fix a pipe. There was no coordination and that's how DDC was created. Mm-hmm. Here we would have capital projects and operations, but without really knowing from operations what the most significant challenges are that then have a cascading effect. Without that collaboration, you really have nothing. You're just gonna be spinning your wheels. So I think that's probably the most significant meeting that we have on a regular basis.
You know, also Andrew, I mean, you I think you sort of answered your own question without knowing it, which is one of your talents.
The not knowing it part?
Well, both.
Just checking.
You can, you know, the data, Lisa's exactly right about the data. I meet once a month with the compliance team and then some of the management team just to go through the dashboards that she talked about. So we have, there's more data than you can imagine. But data, you know, that not all data is created equal, right? So if you think about the work orders, work order reform is huge, and Lisa can talk about that for a long time. But the fact is, if there are more work orders, there was more work orders. And the reason there's more work orders now is because they're remediating lead paint, among other things. Every lead paint remediation has, you know, you have to paint, you've got to do carpentry work, you have to get people out. Each one of those things is a work order. So, and they all get responded to in their own order. So, you know, that is a piece of data that is important, but to my mind, not totally dispositive as to how successful the turnaround has been. If you look at things like lead paint remediation, that's the end of the line. Lead paint remediation means the apartment has been brought back to below the, you know, the health and safety standard that HUD tells us to meet. So when it's done,
city.
The state,
yeah.
When it's
the,
done, yeah,
the
city, all those people. So when it's done, it's done. That's the end of the line. And that, as you said, Bart said, we've been more successful than any other PHA in the country. Same thing with mold remediation. Elevator response times. When the elevator's broken, somebody comes to fix it, that's the response time. Those numbers are down.
And the other thing that we've been doing, which again, it seems so obvious, but it's not something that we had historically done, with elevators, with heating. We now do preventative maintenance. And it's extraordinary to see how preventative maintenance, especially with elevators, actually reduces the outages, which again, we see on our dashboards, right? It seems so obvious. Really, what our heating team does, and we're careening towards the end of heating season, which makes me so happy, but what they do is they then look at the 10 or 15 developments that had the most heat outages for the longest amount of time and really dissect what needs to be done there so that they're not on the top 10 list. There's always going to be somebody on the list. And it just stands to reason given the age and the infrastructure that we have. But making sure that we are taking the low-hanging fruit and really making the changes that we need to.
So let's move to budget. Okay. Things reduced to budget. So as you mentioned, you have a large budget. Some of it's Section 8 and all this stuff, but around $3 billion is your public housing operations budget. And long-run challenges, as we said, with federal support waning over time and rent. So last year, the gap between public housing expenses and core operating income, which you'd like it to pay for itself, last year was about the same as the year before, $791 million. That's huge. And just to give everyone a flavor of what the challenge is, your capital grant from HUD allows you to shift some of it to pay your operating expenses as you need to. So here is this Faustian bargain where you say, I need to pay my bills. The important is I need to fix up, but you move roughly, I don't know, $260 last year over, which is you could have used to fix up 600 apartments. That's the challenge. So you have that budget gap that you have to fill every year, and it's gotten larger over time, although consistent 2 years. Let's look at the revenue side and talk about rent arrears a little more and unpack those numbers. Huge arrears during the pandemic, as you said, $500 million. Advocacy got you some of that plugged by the state, but the collection rates, and it's complicated how you calculate those, are really not going up to where you need it to be. What are you doing to increase that? What is the gap that you think you can close by increasing the rent payments?
So, we talk a lot about when somebody has 3 years worth of arrears. And just to put it in context, the average rent of a NYCHA household is about $525 a month. And the average income is a little under $25,000 a year. So when you owe $6,000 to your landlord, it's devastating. It might as well be $1 million. So ERAP has helped. We've also partnered with HRA to make sure that our residents who are eligible for one-shot deals can receive them. And once they see that balance going down, because every time they get a rent bill, they see what's owed. And it's really pretty overwhelming. We've also worked with individuals to have them sign repayment agreements. And our 12-month rolling average, which was pretty consistent at 60%, is now up close to 66%. It's like 65.8. So we're definitely seeing an upward trend. Because it's a 12-month rolling average, it's going to take us a while to get to the point where we're seeing a substantial change. But $450 million in arrears is something that is going to take strategy. And so having HRA, having repayment agreements, but even somebody with a repayment agreement, we're still going to see that
debt. Just so we can get a handle, on the current month's bill, I think it used to be around 90% right before the pandemic that you received. Now, I'm not sure if that's households or dollars, but it's close enough to the same. What are you on the current month bill these days so we can get a sense of what that was and if you get back up to the 90%, what that would give you?
So HUD doesn't really look at rent arrears, rent collection that way, but I know that we're well above the 90% mark on current rent. But we really, current rent means nothing if we have rent arrears, because we're always going to need that money, and that has consistently gone up.
And you talked about this, the carrots. Are there any sticks in this approach that will help people, encourage people to get current and pay that current month?
So while I was general counsel, and again, coming to NYCHA 3 weeks before the pandemic was certainly a challenge. You know, courts were closed, but that really gave us an opportunity to look at the number of cases that we had outstanding, which, you know, was somewhere in the 30 to 40,000 mark. And what we did was we really went through and we discontinued 30,000 cases, either some that had been brought multiple times against the same owner. And what we really decided to focus on were individuals with the largest amount of arrears for the longest amount of time. Our goal as a public housing authority is to keep people housed. So since the moratorium ended in 2022, we've had 110 evictions. So not very much, although the, you know, landlord-tenant court is incredibly overburdened by every landlord going into court trying to, you know, evict people who might not be paying their rent. So it's really a challenge to find that stick. I like to flip it and say, you pay your rent, it's much easier for us to provide services. We are a 24-hour-a-day operation. We can't, when there's a fire or a power outage, say, you know what, we're not going to show up because that's just not what we do.
So on the spending side, we've done analyses over the years. Your operation maintenance costs are generally been higher when we've compared it to, you know, pre-74 rent stabilized houses are higher. Now we can look at the PAC developers before conversion, and it's higher. And we've looked at both property-based management as a difference in between the NYCHA and how private entities operate, and also the skilled trades and labor and how hard it is for you guys to schedule given the agreements. Is there a way on the spending side to bring that unit cost down?
Andrew and I have talked about this a little bit, you know, behind the scenes. You know, is there a way to bring per unit cost down? Yeah, there is a way to bring the per unit cost down.
And maintain services.
Yeah, absolutely. Invest in the buildings. I mean, that is the only realistic way for us to bring per unit cost down in a sustainable and meaningful, like in a material way. That's it. You know, I know there are landlords. I mean, NYCHA is a landlord, and I'm sure there are other landlords. I know there's some landlords in the room. Raise your hand if you're. No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, there are no private landlords. I guarantee you there's no private landlords, small or large, in this city that operate their buildings with no capital reserves. We have no capital reserves at the building level. That's it. There never have been. There never will be. I mean, there are when you do a PAC building or, you know, some of the other stuff we're going to be doing. But the existing Section 9 public housing has no building level capital reserve to speak of. There's been no investment. You know, it's not a complaint. It's just a fact. Which means that all of those building systems, all the infrastructure, all the units are deteriorating. If you don't fix that, you can throw all the operating costs you want at them, and there's nothing you can do. So bringing down the cost, if you want to bring down the cost without doing that, you have to provide less services, basically. That's where you are.
And there's also been the observation at times, a criticism as you've, and we'll get to the capital in a second, as you've reduced the number of units that you manage, the staff hasn't commensurately reduced. Is that because you needed those staff in the first place, or should overtime being reduced? What's happening with that?
So we need the staff. And if we've had many conversations with HUD, and when they say, when you look at the age and the condition of your buildings, you actually need more staff than the staff that you have. So it's not that, you know, there are people standing around doing nothing. There are people that are really overburdened because there are just not enough people to handle the need that our buildings entail.
So speaking of need, as I said in the beginning, your physical needs assessment, $60 billion over 5 years. There's a 20-year number. Let's just use that. Your five-year capital plan has $8 billion in it. That $60 billion needs some $7 billion or whatever. You're going to correct my estimate, will be reduced because you'll use PACT and the trust, hopefully as quickly as possible. But that's still a huge gap, and your physical plant is in dire shape. As we looked at it, the average rehab cost, and this is not just what you put into the unit, but the average rehab cost is $370,000 a unit, and we estimate that a third of the units are at or near what the cost it would be to, that where it makes more sense to rebuild than rehabilitate. That's pretty tough. You have a lot of tools at your, three tools at your disposal, PACT, RAD, and Section 9. Tell us the progress you're making and the challenges that remain.
So I think PACT is probably our greatest success story. Jonathan Gouveia, who heads our real estate department, is here. And we have made really incredible progress. At the start of PACT, and I wasn't here at the time, I think there was an incredible resistance. The RAD program was something that was used all over the country. It was slow to pick up momentum here in New York. But now we see our residents who are living in traditional Section 9 developments, who are going to visit PACT sites that have been rehabilitated, and they're like, this is what I want. The pictures are unbelievable, the before and after. And so we have about 20,000 apartments that have been converted, about 17,000 that are in varying stages of resident engagement and discussions with both residents. I think one of the things that we have done, which was not something that was historically done at NYCHA, was we have done incredible resident engagement, really making sure that the residents have a voice and that we're listening to what they believe that they need and what they believe is best for their community. Jamie and I worked together at the Governor's Office of Storm Recovery, and one of the things that we would say all the time was, nobody knows what a community needs better than the people who actually live in the community. And I think that that's something that we've really taken to heart at NYCHA, that the needs and the wants of somebody living in Stapleton in Staten Island is going to be a little different than the folks living in Fulton Alley at Chelsea.
So for those who don't live this, Rental Assistance Demonstration, RAD, partnering with a private developer and manager, you can convert your federal subsidy into a Section 8 income stream, so private capital can come to the table, there can be rehabilitation and management by a private company. We've been huge supporters of the trust, which instead of that private company, now there is a public benefit corporation set up to play that role. The challenge and public engagement, I sat there for a year thanks to Vicky and learned a lot. The challenge is time is not your friend.
No.
Those needs increased tremendously between 2017 and 2023 or 2022 when it was probably done. And in part, maybe it's a more complete needs assessment, but time is not your friend. Between inflation, deterioration, the time it takes to do that, during that time, buildings are crumbling. How can you accelerate that? I understand the desire and need for engagement, but you mentioned 17,000 more in the PAC pipeline. There's more that you'll get done, but they're deteriorating every day. Mm-hmm. You have 175,000 units. What do you do? Because you don't have the money or time.
So time is what we don't have, and time is really what we need. And I think that's why...
That sounds tough.
It really is. And we have not a lot of money. So those two things together, you know, make this fairly challenging. But I think that's why we can't... That's why the trust was created. That's why we're using comprehensive modernization. That's why our capital program last year spent $1 billion. So we can't put all of our eggs in one basket. We are really attacking the problem at all fronts. We have PACT, we have the trust, which you know should rehabilitate 25,000. That's what we're allowed to under the terms of the statute. We have comprehensive modernization. We have our very robust capital program. When you think about spending $1 billion in a year on capital needs, it's really extraordinary. Our goal is to exceed that this year. I'm also working with operations. And then we have other projects. For example, our mold team goes into buildings working with both capital and operations and replaces stacks. So we are really hitting it at all fronts, and that's what's going to give us the momentum. We might not have the time that we need, and certainly the buildings continue to deteriorate. You know, we focus on the buildings that have the greatest need when we're making our decisions. We do have some buildings that are actually in pretty good shape, all things considered.
I mean, that's one of the things, Andrew, you mentioned the P&A, the physical needs assessment. You know, the physical needs assessment is calculated by some outside outside firm, and they use whatever the standards are to do it. You know, there's a lot of argument about whether it's a right number. It's never going to be the right number. The question is it too high or too low? I think there's probably an argument that it's too high if you actually get on top of things quickly, because a lot of it is calculated. Some of it is calculated based on what they think it's going to cost over that period of time. Well, obviously, the faster you move, the smaller the, you know, you can exponentially shrink the numbers. So, and I think the problem with that, frankly, is that if you talk about a $78 billion number, it sounds like it's not solvable. I don't believe that. I think it is solvable. And I think it's solvable with the tools that we have that Lisa talked about. Obviously, we need more support from the federal government. We need more support from everybody. But there's some things that I think can happen without, you know, giant amounts of $40 billion is not coming from the infrastructure bill that we had planned on. So PACT, we need more PACT developers. There are some great PACT developers in this room. I saw David Kramer, Kareem Hudson, I think, is here, others. We need more. And we need more big parties to show up, and we're working with some of the folks here and others to think about different structures so that we can bring in bigger pools of capital. There are multi-billion dollar funds in the world that want to invest in stable government-owned infrastructure that don't look at NYCHA yet. We can bring them in and drive things more quickly. Same structures, more capital.
I appreciate your optimism.
I'm not optimistic. But you know, and so there are solutions to bringing people. I'm convinced of it. The second is you talked about what we're doing in Chelsea, where you spent all that time. I walked over to Chelsea yesterday and we looked around at what we're doing. For those of you who don't know, there's I forget how many buildings. What is it, 11 buildings? I don't know, some number of buildings. 2,000 apartments 17. In Chelsea. 17 buildings, 2,000 apartments. Over time and in partnership with Related, they're all going to come down and be replaced by better housing, plus, by the way, new market rate and mixed-use housing. It's an incredible project. If you go look at it, it's, you know, two four-square blocks, a whole neighborhood that's going to be reimagined. That is a faster, more efficient way to remake NYCHA, and that's, frankly, where we're going to be looking for bigger opportunities going forward, and we'll talk more about that some other time. The third is you have to realize that this is New York City's housing problem. The part of the problem that we've got is that New York City has a housing crisis. There are no vacancies to move people into. If you take down a building, Kareem knows this, he's nodding his head. If you want to do a PACT program, you can't just tell the people they've got to go live somewhere else for 3 years while their building gets redone. They've got to have someplace to move into, either another one of our apartments or someplace else that the developer finds them. There's a 1% vacancy rate in the city. Where are you going to move these people? So it takes, you know, X times as long to do that project. Well, that's time we don't have. So if the city figured out how to develop more housing faster, NYCHA's problems would be solved faster. It's all part of the same issue. So that means ULURP reform, that means zoning reform, that means all the stuff that people talk about, that means 421A, that means all the stuff we can throw at the housing problem, not the NYCHA problem.
But it also means using the available land
absolutely
on NYCHA properties, which is your absolutely land rich relatively in certain ways, as you know, but there's been a challenge. The last question before we open it up, but the challenge is, in 5 years, you will make progress, and whatever remains, which will be certainly the majority of the stock, will be in much worse shape. And I don't know how that cycle works, but if we're going to have 75,000 units at some point that's falling on people, that's terrible. And I'm not saying you're not pulling out all the stops and doing it, but we haven't confronted, and we don't have a solution to that. And your optimism is good, so maybe the number's a little off, but it's looking pretty bad. Right now, we know. And the original plan for Chelsea was to tear down and rebuild chunks of it. Mm-hmm. It was rejected by, you know, political and tenant forces, and that's why the task force happened. And look, we're coming back to something that's a little different than the original plan, but conceptually the same. Can you move that en masse quickly, and would that help? And what does it take politically to get there? Because tenants' housing stability and quality hangs in the balance. Can you accelerate that?
I mean, we're trying to move as quickly as possible, but it's not a quick process. Nothing around land use is a quick process, period. Nothing around construction is a quick process. You know, we see, just thinking about the infrastructure that's been done after Hurricane Sandy, it's 12 years and the large infrastructure projects are still not done. And those are moving fast. They had all the money that they needed for the most part. But I think when you have a situation like Fulton Elliott Chelsea, where the tenant leaders are coming to you saying, you know what, we're tired of living in these buildings, we want to change, that's an impetus to move quickly.
They need to be your evangelists.
Exactly. Absolutely. That's exactly right.
So let's open up to some questions from our trustees. I know I talked to some beforehand, so I'll look at, because people had a great interest. Let's look at Hal, and I'll keep looking. So raise your hands as Hal is.
Lisa, you just said it, that you had the support of the leaders in Chelsea. And not going into my own personal case, at Holmes, we didn't. And they fought us. Unfortunately for Jonathan Gavaya, it was his fifth day working in NYCHA, who had to spend 6 hours with people screaming at him. But even today, they don't want anything there. So how do you take Holmes? How do you fix Holmes?
So I'm not sure we have enough time to talk about how to fix Holmes, but I can tell you it's very helpful sometimes to put yourself in the shoes of an individual who makes $25,000 a year, who does not have the support from family or friends, and knowing that if they lose their apartment, the next stop is a homeless shelter, which there's no, you know, there are not vacant beds there at this moment either. So change is hard. The thought of rebuilding is hard. The thought of even being temporarily displaced is very hard. So that's why working with our residents, that's why, the engagement that we have done for the trust has been so detailed and so like hands-on and white glove, because we really want to explain to people that they're going to be moving back. However, NYCHA has not always been transparent, and there's a lot of distrust, and I get that. So I think you see momentum when people see results. And I think that that's why, you know, Fulton Elliott Chelsea is really going to be a defining moment. If we move people out, we build a building, we move them back in, I think we're going to have people lining up asking for the same things. And I think your challenge is going to be solved.
I saw Karim, and I'm keeping looking for hands. Karim, go ahead.
So I just wanted to make one quick comment. I don't think CPC was implying this, and it goes to Hal's question. I think one of the greatest parts of RAD is resident engagement and doing that effectively. And I don't think even if we have a time issue, we should have any thought process about reducing the amount of resident engagement that we're doing. It is exactly what is allowing PAC to be successful. But I did want to go back, because I know these points around the replacement costs and the cost of repair are equal or more, and in people's mind, I guess they assume maybe we just knock down everything and then we'll just build new. And I just want to make sure that you guys have the time to respond to that, because look, as an affordable housing and a preservation developer, that's never the realistic solution. We have to preserve housing as well as build new construction. But I think when we throw out numbers like replacement costs are higher than this and that, people think, oh, let's just knock it all down. Can you guys respond to that and explain why that is or is not the right solution?
Thank you, Karim.
Absolutely. And I can say with certainty, we are not knocking everything down. That is not our plan. We, as I said before, really have to focus on an approach that looks at everything. Rehabilitation, rebuilding when necessary, and using the tools that we have. But preservation is just as important as rebuilding.
Look, if you want to, I totally agree with that. If the average cost per unit to, or if the average cost to fix our unit is, I don't know, we'll call it $500,000, that means we've got some at $250,000 and some at $750,000. $750,000 is too high. $250,000 is absolutely worth rehabilitating. There's no point in knocking the building down. And we know what those are. We just have to work our way through them. But, you know, the cost, you know better than I do, the things that drive up the cost per unit are the same thing in NYCHA, are the same things to some extent that drive up the cost per unit in any other place you're developing in this city. There's, you know, there's insurance costs that are too high. There's, you know, there's all kinds of tax things. I'm not here to comment about labor costs, but labor costs in the city are very high. And all kinds of labor costs are high. Material costs, all that stuff that drives up the cost of building in New York City drives up the cost of building in NYCHA. That's where we work. So, you know, to some extent, there's nothing that we can do about that. It's going to be a cost also on the total rebuilding.
And I saw Jake. I'm trying to look longer than I usually do. So first Jake, and then I'll keep going. Jake is back there. Sean, to your left.
thank you. Yeah, I guess maybe you mentioned labor cost, and maybe just earlier you said there's sort of a limited number of variables you've got control to tweak over. I'm just wondering, like, how do you handle that on a day-to-day basis? Meaning, where my mind goes when I hear about NYCHA is what do you build that bid out system-wide, and what do you try to decentralize and have sort of empower local, I don't know whether they're district managers or individual building managers to just constantly be built. Because you're constantly running up against time versus cost, and I imagine that's a, you know, there's a spectrum there, and so how do you make those decisions?
So work order reform, we've really tried to decentralize so that we have skilled trades, and obviously every development has carpenters and maintenance workers and supers and caretakers, but the larger scale systemic decisions are made in the central office.
I saw Juan.
One
second. There you go. Now we can all hear it.
Hi, I was just curious. I don't really know if age demographics falls into play in your long-term planning and how to rehabilitate or move or not move people.
That's actually a great question because NYCHA residents are getting older. We have a large number. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but a lot of seniors, people that are over the age of 60, two or so. So thinking about accessibility is certainly something that's a challenge. I know it's been a challenge in our RAD program, and it's certainly a challenge in our regular Section 9 portfolio.
And also the challenge as children leave of downsizing apartments, you have families waiting. You're waiting, you know, you have families waiting, and you have people who had three bedrooms when they needed with their kids. That's always been a challenge. Can you just speak for a second? Because I know with RAD, there's been some downsizing, but it's tough in the Section 9 portfolio. Could you be doing more in that? What are the challenges there?
So it's something that, you know, it's obviously a federal requirement. So it's something that we certainly grapple with. I know for RAD, unless there's an apartment available to downsize into, the person stays in their unit. But it's one of the greatest challenges that we have.
And I saw Jack, and I'm keeping up looking.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm curious, and Jenny, you said it well, this ties into what was just discussed. We have a housing crisis, obviously, in New York City and across the country. What are your waiting lists look like? Like, what is the demand for NYCHA housing look? I mean, I know we're not building and expanding, but I'm just curious if you have a good handle on that.
Mm-hmm.
We have over 250,000 people on our waiting list.
And how many come off it? We've talked about this before. I can't remember the number, but
so it's interesting. It was about 300,000 last year. So people have to continually show interest. So a whole bunch of people, I looked at the number and I was like, wait a minute, we certainly didn't move that many people in. But yes, it's generational.
250,000 people on the waiting list, 100 evictions over that period of time. So that's not why people are vacating.
In 2 years,
we have 5,000 vacant units, yeah. About 4,000 of which, or I think, most of which are vacant because they have lead paint. Or they have, you know, they're uninhabitable for whatever reason. So it's not like there's people sitting around, you know, we have vacant units just because we have vacant units. You need some swing units. So there is basically no vacancy in NYCHA. And on top of that, when a vacancy comes available, one of the things that often happens is the Department of Homeless Services puts goes to the front of the line with some of their people. So
we also have a lot of people who want to transfer,
right?
Whether they want to transfer into a senior development, whether they need ADA accessibility. I mean, it's really like a big giant puzzle.
Yeah, and since I had the luxury of looking up all the numbers last night, 8,700 empty units, 5,100 classified vacant, 3,600 is non-dwelling and being fixed up.
Yeah, so they're used as, those are used for like TA spaces and things like that. So they're like off the rent roll.
And the turnover time, and part of it I assume is lead, turnover time was less than 2 months before pandemic, and now it's at 14 months. Is that all lead increase?
Well, so what we do now, we've made the decision that when we turn over a unit, we're going to remediate it for lead, mold, and asbestos, so that it's safe from environmental hazards. That's not something that we did before, but it's something that certainly takes time. And now we know that when somebody is moving into a unit, it's going to be environmentally safe.
Yeah, and but it also comes at the cost of that time, and that's the challenge of time not being your friend, even though sometimes it's demanded. Margo, I saw you earlier, if you're still there.
So my question is about a little bit of a different topic, which is internet access in existing NYCHA facilities. And I know the temptation can be when you're talking about lead paint and environmental hazards and running water and keeping the heat on to start to think about internet access as something as a luxury. But we also found out during the pandemic that that's not the case, and that having a broadband, a reliable, affordable broadband connection is really the gateway to so many things, whether it's school or education or registering for a vaccine appointment. And so I'm curious how you think about that in the context of existing NYCHA facilities, both from the perspective of necessary upgrades, but also from the perspective of just making sure that it is affordable, especially given that some of the federal safety nets like the ACP program are likely going away and a few other things that made it more affordable for people who have a $25,000 a year budget to manage.
That's a really great question because, as you know, most of us can't live without internet. The city has a broadband program that has been rolled out at NYCHA Developments. And so we've really been relying on OTI and the city to provide that access to our residents, because as you said, you know, when you're thinking about what we can afford, we are trying to provide the most basic services to make our apartments, you know, decent, safe, and sanitary. But we've been really looking to the city for the broadband access.
Rapid fire, Kent, and then a hand back there. I can see a hand. There you go. So Kent, quick, and then one more, and then we'll let you guys go. I'll ask you how someone so nice can do this. So keep going, Kent. Okay, you use your pipes, Kent. There you go.
Thanks for being here. It's often been stated or assumed over decades that outdated HUD regulations and labor work rules have really hamstrung NYCHA's ability to more efficiently manage and operate its portfolio. My impression is that the monitorship provides the opportunity, that might be, you can correct me if I'm wrong, to seek waivers from HUD and to perhaps use the courts to try to address some of the labor work rule problems. Is any of that true, number one? And number two, if it is, do you have a top 10 list of things that you would like to pursue with the new monitor with HUD and the Southern District?
Also a great question. So the HUD agreement does give the secretary broad powers that the monitor can request regarding a host of items, not only labor. You know, as you know, Marcia Fudge just stepped down. Adrian Todman has taken over. It's not something that we've really discussed either with the monitor or internally at this point. We've really just been trying to, you know, keep the trains running. But it's certainly something that we will raise with the monitor, or the monitor will raise with us. And, you know, the next time we're invited, we can probably give you more information about that.
And I overestimated. So I'm going to take your question later and get them, because they have to get to a board meeting, as Lisa's been so kind to remind me. So I apologize. I do want to say, Ken, thank you for that question. We have a few times reiterated what we think the monitor should help you with and give you the tools to manage well and efficiently. We'd love to support you in that. We'd also love to thank you for spending the time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Bye.